You've been working on the left as a journalist, you know, kind of a, as a commentator. I think of you as a commentator on the left. How do you find the current political climate and the reception of your work today as compared to, say, 3-4 years ago?
You know, I think that there's just a lot of confusion right now about what the project is and where we're going.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
we still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Diet Soap is a Sublation Media podcast. Freddie DeBoer is back on the podcast again. Freddie, I'm always glad to talk to you. You are a journalist and a blogger. Would calling you a blogger be accurate?
It would be accurate. I have always hated the word blog, which is something of a professional hazard for me. So I just prefer writer and academic, but I'll answer to blogger, sure.
How many different periodicals have you written for? I noticed that you've written for Compact, which is the one we're going to be talking about today. Do you have any idea how many different periodicals that you've written
something
for?
Like 40, I think, different places over the course of my career. Yeah.
All right. So you wrote this piece for Compact called "The Left's Vapid Anti-Musk Discourse." I guess I'll just ask you to tell me, why do you think it is that the left, and I'm not sure we should call the group that's so upset about Musk the left, but the left is so upset about Elon Musk acquiring Twitter.
Yeah, so first I'll start just by reminding everyone that the writer does not choose the headline.
Okay. So
I think that if we are distinguishing the left from liberals, I think that this is more of a liberal phenomenon than it is of a left-wing one. But I think there's plenty of lefties who sort of take part in this as well. One thing to note about this piece is that it lives behind Compact's paywall. I am a believer in the necessity of paywalls for independent journalism and media to survive. I think that, you know, whether it's on Patreon or your own or on Substack or on your own paywall system, I'm a supporter of paywalls, and so I have no problem with Compact's decision. Unfortunately, it made it even more likely that the piece was going to be interpreted as a pro Elon Musk piece, which it is not. My basic argument, I think I would decompose it down into a few parts. I think that number one, Elon Musk is bad in the way that all billionaires are bad. And I think that there are specific aspects of his conduct that you can call bad. Such as, I think recently he sent out a memo demanding, you know, Twitter workers work long hours into the night or whatever. And this is bog standard, you know, capitalist exploiting labor and therefore immoral sort of stuff, which, of course, I recognize as bad. But we should remember, first of all, that if we take a sort of Marxist or Marxian view of society seriously, you know, Marx talks about capital and the bourgeoisie as having a certain amount of fungibility, meaning, you know, when we call Marxism a structural critique of capitalism, part of the point is that the individual at the head of the capitalist enterprise, their character is not what makes them suboptimal, right? In other words, the problem with capitalism is not that it does not have a smiling face. The problem with capitalism is that, you know, the rate of exploitation is at the center of capitalist exchange. That is how exchange happens, is because of a working class that trades its labor value for less than it receives in return for what it creates. And so to remind people that there is a structural aspect where the billionaires who previously owned Twitter were not the good billionaires, right? I also would say that if we're going to be comparing behaviors, there are people who have behaviors that, from a left-wing perspective, I think would be seen as transparently worse than Musk. And so what I noted in the Compact piece is that prior to Musk's takeover, I believe the single largest holder of Twitter stock, the largest lion's share, the biggest share of the ownership of the company was held by the sovereign wealth fund of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, or at least by Saudi princes who are working in that regard. And of course, Saudi Arabia is a corrupt and brutal theocratic autocracy that beheads people for being gay, that stones women to death for committing adultery. And that seems to me to be, if we're going to sort of say who's bad, right? That would seem to me to be worse than a guy who's genuinely an asshole, but who is primarily known for running an electric car company. And I would finally say, I think that, this just seems mostly driven by annoyance at Musk because he is omnipresent in the sense that he never stops tweeting. The journalist and political class tend to be Twitter power users who are very exposed to that ecosystem. And so they can't get away from his tweets. He's got, I think, over 100 million followers or whatever. And so he's playing with their toy, but also he's there in their face sharing stupid right-wing memes or whatever else he's doing on a day-to-day basis.
Finally, let's get to this. Let's put this up there on the screen. Elon now saying that the Twitter files on free speech suppression will soon be published on Twitter itself.
All right, and also a little more Bay Area tech turmoil. Elon Musk is taking aim at Apple amid rumors that the App Store might stop offering Twitter.
FCC has officially asked Google and Apple to remove TikTok from their app stores because of its pattern of surreptitious data practices.
Franz, can you try to break this glass, please? Yeah.
Sure?
Yeah. Oh my God. Well, maybe that was a little too hard.
My assumption, I have no idea who the CEO of ExxonMobil is, right? Mm-hmm. And he's not on Twitter sharing Pepe the Frog memes, right? Mm-hmm. But I am sure that he is a bad human being, and that an interpersonally and politically bad human being. And so a lot about this is just like availability bias, that people are angry in large measure because Musk is there to be observed at all times, whereas a lot of the masters of capital are smart enough to stay quiet.
What would you say to someone who said, okay, Musk is different than other billionaire CEOs in so much as he has purchased a media company, and that we might want to compare him to someone like Rupert Murdoch as a political force rather than to the CEO of Exxon? Because while, you know, the CEO of Exxon might be implementing all sorts of corporate policies that do tremendous damage to the earth, it's people like Rupert Murdoch that provide the political and ideological cover for the Exxon executive. And it matters what the attitudes of the corporate overlords are, especially when it comes to owning the media.
Yeah, I think that is a fair critique. And I think that that's an argument that has a lot of merit to it. But I would, again, sort of say, let's locate this in a broader context, right? Mm. If Musk is like Rupert Murdoch, then so is Jeff Bezos, the other serious contender for world's richest man and the owner of Amazon, a company that practices just systematically horrific labor abuses. And he owns the Washington Post, which, unlike the shit tweets that Elon Musk sends out, the Washington Post has this veneer of authority and credibility, etc. I believe The Atlantic, the magazine, is now principally owned by the widow of Steve Jobs, although I could be wrong about that.
No, I think you're right. I've heard that anyway.
Yeah. Or even just look at like the Sulzberger family who owns the New York Times, right? Now they are orders of magnitudes less wealthy than Bezos or Musk. But they are still, you know, multi-millionaires who are part of the rentier class. They're members of the bourgeoisie who own an organ of immense influence, probably the single most influential publication in the world. And I would say that, well, as someone who's written for The New York Times, it would be quite hypocritical of me to wipe my hands of it. I think that, like, you can't argue that their position at the top of that paper is irrelevant to how the paper operates. And many people have for many years argued that beneath the layer of genteel liberalism that tends to predominate in the New York Times, you have, you know, a replication of or a desire to replicate the, you know, the basic functions of capitalism. So in that sense, I think, yes, like it is scary from a certain sense that someone like Musk can come in and purchase one of these actually small by usership, but influential, certainly, social media companies. But I think that to do so selectively, again, with the example of Jeff Bezos, the major difference is that, you know, Jeff Bezos isn't shit posting into all hours of the night every day. And so he attracts somewhat less ire because he's just not putting out his idiot opinions to be critiqued.
Let me flip this on its head and dare to take a pro Elon position for a moment. Yes, Musk is obnoxious. Yes, Musk apparently propagates right-wing memes, but I think he propagates all sorts of different, like he's kind of like the Joe Rogan of billionaires is how I think of Musk. Maybe he's been on Joe Rogan. And one of the reasons he was so interested, apparently stated the reasons that he was so interested in acquiring Twitter, was because he was tired of the platform maybe censoring him or censoring people he followed. And he wanted to create a free speech version of Twitter. At least that's a kind of impression I got. Do you think that the people who are so upset about Musk's acquisition are actually committed to using big tech to do the opposite, to try to control the discourse and, you know, to make sure that the wrong opinions aren't widely heard?
So, yeah, I want to approach that from a couple of different angles. I think one of the first things that I want to say is, you made the comparison to Joe Rogan, and I think that this is an apt comparison because one thing that I think a lot of people like you and me, people who are marinated in politics and think about it all the time, we read tons of political media and we know the lay of the land and, you know, we know our Hayek from our Keynes, et cetera. It's very easy to assume that everyone has like a particularly coherent political ideology, right, that they can express where the pieces sort of fit together and you have your moral philosophy, which sort of influences your thoughts on procedure and which dictates, you know, the policy that you want. And one of the things I like to point out to people is like, that's not true for a very large number of people. Right. So
it's probably the majority, right?
I mean, the majority, right? So it's if you look at the research about like people who don't vote or people who are registered independents or the mythical swing voter, what that shows is like they are not in general committed centrists who just are like have an ideology where the center of the position between left and right is always correct. Those people generally, the political science research shows, just have incoherent politics to most of us. Right. They believe things that don't make a lot of sense. Like this is the famous poll respondents where, you know, there's this classic dynamic in polling where you talk about should the government cut taxes and balance the budget and strip back, and people in the abstract will say yes. And then you'll list a number of programs like Medicare, Social Security, food stamps, et cetera, and say, what should they cut? And they say no to all of it. Right. Mm-hmm. They want small government, except that they want to preserve every actually existing government program, right? My read on Musk is that he's kind of one of these people where I'm sure he has domain-specific knowledge in the sort of engineering of electric cars and of rockets or whatever. But I don't think that he really knows what he's doing politically. I think that he is a good example of someone who can sort of be blown in the wind. I have a certain affection for Joe Rogan. I don't think that he's an unintelligent guy by any means, but I do think that like there's this this facet of Joe Rogan where if you watch his show long enough or listen to his show long enough, you realize that he just believes whatever the last person he talked to told him. Right. Like, you know, like if you're trying to stitch together a coherent ideology from him and you watch these different interviews, it's disorienting because it doesn't seem to make sense in that way. And I suspect mm-hmm. that's true of Musk. I think he's an opportunistic billionaire and a capitalist and someone who wants low taxes and not a lot of regulation and to not pay his workforce very well. And of course, that's an ideological position. But I don't think that he's like a committed, you know, conservative in any intellectual way that makes sense.
That they're hitting people and spraying that girl in the face. The girl was really disturbing because she was talking to someone. She wasn't offering any threat. And she had a hat that looked like a Make America Great Again hat, but it said Make Bitcoin Great Sure. Again. How could you ever, in any other scenario, justify beating a woman publicly for doing nothing but representing what you think is offensive, and you're even wrong about what she's representing?
Here's the problem with what you're doing, and I did this too much too. You're intellectualizing a fashion movement. This is the Mods and the Rockers in Brighton Beach in 1961, just fighting each other because one likes Elvis and the other likes The Who. And if you were to sit down with this mod and this rocker and say, have a debate, they wouldn't say anything. They have nothing to say. It's leather versus parkas. It's Vespas versus Triumph motorbikes.
Do you think that that's maybe the lens that we should look at something like democratic socialism through? Not that it can't work, but that it hasn't been implemented correctly before.
That's exactly. That's why we got to get beyond the ism. You're absolutely right. See, what makes not just the United States, there's been democratic experiments all around the world in various circumstances. We become central stage because we become a world power that understands itself as a democracy with all the contradictions that go hand in hand with that. Begin as a settler colonial enterprise, still got slavery, patriarchy. Workers don't have the right to engage in collective bargaining in the United States until the 1930s.
Now things have changed. Now we have multiple sidings by multiple modes. That is the gold standard. The gold standard for looking for these objects. Not just one person, but several people that are reputable. Not just radar, but visual sighting, infrared sensors, telescopic evidence. Now we have multiple sightings by multiple modes. And so the burden of proof has shifted. It used to be the burden of proof was on the people who believed in UFOs. They saw something, prove it. Now the burden of proof has shifted to the Pentagon, to the military. Now they have to prove that these aren't extraterrestrial.
As far as the free speech question goes, I mean, look, I am something of an old school free speech absolutist. Mm-hmm. I am also understand that it's true that you can't, like, look, if I start a private platform, like, for example, the comments section of my newsletter, I very, very rarely have to moderate comments or delete anything, but occasionally I will, right? If it's spam or if it includes some sort of a threat of physical violence, you know, extreme situations like that, I'll do it. And, you know, I have the right to moderate my newsletter's comments as it's a, you know, private enterprise, and it's not, I never said that it was a free forum for everybody. Mm-hmm. I think that, yes, I think that one of the things that liberals have, particularly media liberals, have taken for granted is the idea that they will always be the one wielding the ban hammer, meaning that mm-hmm. like when there is censoring to be done, they will be the censor and not the censored. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is an uncomfortable position for them to be in. I think it's particularly uncomfortable because under previous ownership, the common claim by conservatives was that Twitter was far more likely to suspend or ban someone for expressing conservative opinion than a liberal opinion. So a good example of this is their COVID-19 misinformation policies, which for a time prevented you from even talking about the lab leak hypothesis on their platform. Or another famous example is the Hunter Biden laptop story, which Twitter banned from being posted. You could not post the New York Post article, et cetera. And what a lot of liberals said in response to this is they said, hey, look, Twitter's a private company. They can do whatever they want. Well, now we're kind of on the opposite end of that, right? Mm-hmm. If you said that Twitter is a private company, can do whatever it wants about COVID or Hunter or Biden, the exact same argument applies to Elon Musk's Twitter. And if he owns the thing and he can do with it what he wants.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And what he stated he wants to do is create a platform for free expression, more free than it was before. However, so far, there's been no changes to policy that I've heard about. And the only, like my kid, Noah, my youngest, has decided to no longer use Twitter because I guess Musk had said you cannot create a parody account unless you label it as a parody account.
Right.
Because of the hypocrisy of that, my, you know, moralistic little teenager has decided he's had enough. So I don't know if it's going to have a dramatic impact, but I would imagine that examples precisely like the lab leak hypothesis or the questioning vaccination or the Hunter Biden laptop story would be examples where Musk would be far less likely to censor than the Twitter that we knew in the past.
That's the assumption. But I think, and again, like, I think the hypocrisy argument is correct. And I trust me when I say that I don't never have assumed that like Elon Musk is going to actually be a consistent civil libertarian champion for free speech. Right. I think that just gets back to what I was saying a moment ago, which is that I doubt very seriously that he has a coherent explanation of what free speech means to him. Right. Mm-hmm. Like for what he is observing as an absolutely obsessive Twitter user, right, is that people who believe some things that he believes and people he likes are getting banned on Twitter or are getting suspended on Twitter. So he says, I'm going to be the free speech champion and I'm going to take over the network. But again, I don't trust him at all to have a coherent definition of what free speech means. You know, I just don't.
Twitter chatter still going on, especially with regards to concerns of free speech. Now, addressing the elephant in the room, Elon Musk has now, in fact, tweeted early this morning. Essentially, let me just read out what exactly he said. He basically said that there's been an extreme antibody reaction from few people on his comment that he is a free speech absolutist. He's also, in fact, said that free speech, according to him, means that which matches with law. And he's against censorship that goes beyond the law.
But as Tesla grows more dependent on China, academics and other Western observers say that Beijing could in turn gain more leverage over Musk's Twitter business.
What people are particularly concerned about is the fact that China has in the past used its access to the large consumer market to squeeze foreign companies in order to make them do something that is aligned with China's own political goals and aims.
So after Musk pulled off a $44 billion deal to buy Twitter, promising more free speech on the platform, he will also face a higher risk of upsetting Beijing.
Tesla is largely beholden to Beijing's goodwill when it comes to manufacturing, production, you know, stoppages, supply chain. Everything.
Twitter declined to comment. Tesla and Musk didn't respond to our request for comment. And when asked whether China could use Tesla's leverage against Musk, the foreign ministry spokesperson brushed off the question.
And I think that this is, if you're someone like me, I try to be a coherent civil libertarian and to have certain principles that undergird my thoughts on free speech, et cetera. And one of the awful things about the present moment is that the people claiming to speak for free speech are almost exclusively conservative idiots, right? Like we just, the problem with free speech right now is not that it doesn't have enough advocates. It's that so many advocates of free speech are transparently hypocritical, are transparently self-interested, and are transparently like just not actually motivated by the principles that underlie the notion of free speech.
Yeah, I think that straight ahead kind of liberals should be. The free speech advocates. The ACLU, for example, is an institution that was set up to defend civil liberties and free speech being primary amongst them. And even the ACLU has seemingly abandoned, to some degree or another, that position. So while I completely agree with you that the only voices that you can hear championing free speech right now on a consistent basis are right wing, for the most part. You also can, they inevitably and invariably are hypocritical in the way that they approach it. A good example, I think, is Jordan Peterson, who would come out advocating for free speech. And then, precisely maybe a day later would say he wants to ban, neo-Marxism from universities or something like that.
I mean, and Peterson is also someone who is this committed opponent of Marxism. And it has been pointed out to him that the way that he represents Marxism has nothing to do with what's actually in Marxist thought. And he has said, oh, I don't need to read it. I mean, he has defended critiquing it without reading it. So I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised that he is also not a particularly consistent in his vision of free speech.
Yeah, and he's not that important. I think he's an overblown figure, but he comes to mind. I feel as though part of the – maybe that I'm reading in too much. I feel as though part of the point of your piece about Musk is to at least start to insinuate that there are ways to approach critiquing the media and the digital media that might be more fruitful and – that might help us create a more free and open environment. Do you hold that maybe the institutions like Twitter or Facebook ought to be nationalized? Public services?
I think that you can easily imagine a public version of, we only need to go back to the beginning of the internet. Mm-hmm. To see a public version of the internet, because the internet was created by the public sector, right?
Usenet.
This is what when people talk about the sort of free market, creating all these internet bounties, we always have to remember the fundamental technologies were built by government. Now, they were built as part of a Cold War against the USSR and for sort of transparently military purposes, so we shouldn't get too glad about them. But if we created a public Twitter, if there was a nationalized Twitter, I think it could be a useful tool. We should remember that tool as a government agency would then operate under the auspices of the First Amendment in a way that Twitter does not. Right. Mm-hmm. And that is for me an appealing prospect in the idea of any kind of idea being able to put out there. But you can also imagine how it would be immediately overwhelmed with spam, with scams, with all manner of stuff that degrades the user experience in a way that could make it almost unusable because the bar for what government would be allowed to regulate would be much higher. I mean,
I think they might be able to regulate spam.
Yeah.
You know, I think that I don't know if spam would be constitutionally protected.
Especially because
it so often would be automated. Mm-hmm. And the entities behind it are often not clear. You know, fraudulent speech isn't protected speech, right? If you promise like I saw on Facebook that someone was advertising a bracelet that if you wore it, you would lose like 400 pounds or something. That's not constitutionally protected speech.
You can imagine, right, what like the condition that would follow would be the people making the moderation decisions would be, you know, ultimately federal employees, right? Government mm-hmm. employees.
Appointed by this or that administration, maybe.
Appointed by this or that administration. And Republicans or conservatives would argue that public sector employees have an inherent bias against conservatives, which is something that they already say with many of the. So, you know, you can find, for example, the Smithsonian Museum system, which is our federal system of museums, there is constant, if you look for it, constant chatter among conservatives about the fact that the very fact that it is a publicly funded and publicly run by public sector employees sort of system means that it's inherently biased against conservatives, etc. So you can imagine that even with our new public Twitter, you would get immediate conservative complaints that they're being unfairly censored. I mean, for me, right. I'm just very public or private. I think that services like Twitter, it's not clear to me how much public good they'll ever provide, because the inherent incentives of the demand for more and more attention, right, drives people to say sensationalistic and extreme things that are not very well thought out, and will often reward things that are dubiously sourced if they're sensationalist enough. So I'll give you a good example from Twitter that I just caught on. I was reading about this today. There is a sort of pollster slash pundit guy named Sean McElwain, who invented the slogan "Abolish ICE." I don't like the slogan "Abolish ICE." I think that it's kind of empty sloganeering for reasons that I'd be happy to talk about. But he runs a place called Data for Progress, which is sort of a polling firm, a democratically aligned polling firm. There's been a lot of complaints about his brand of progressive politics. And not without reason. On Twitter a couple days ago, he was accused of losing $50,000 on prediction markets. So for those who don't know, prediction markets are they're essentially casinos, like sports books, where instead of betting on the Philadelphia Eagles or the New York Yankees, you're betting on certain events to occur. And one of the things that they bet on is they bet on the outcomes of presidential elections. Mm-hmm. Now, it turns out that Data for Progress is this guy's polling firm. It turns out that their predictions were quite off for the midterms. They were predicting a Republican wave that did not materialize. Mm-hmm. He was accused in an interview that went viral on Twitter of having lost $50,000 in the predictions markets based on that. On the results of the midterms
personally or for Democrats?
He personally had bet $50,000 and lost it. And the allegation is that, well, look, if you're a polling firm, then you have an ability to influence the market that you are then betting on. And not only did you lose $50,000, you're losing your credibility and your ethics. This went in a certain circle, right? This is obviously kind of esoteric, but in certain circles, this went big viral. Mm-hmm. And people were sharing that data point back and forth. finally, eventually, some people say, like, where is this information coming from that he lost $50,000? And it appears that an anonymous Twitter account just kind of made that number up, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a big Sean McElwee fan, but that seems really fucked up to me, where you're calling somebody's basic integrity as a member of a professional community into question based on very thinly sourced information.
Now, this came up in an interview.
Yeah. So what
did he deny it in the interview?
So it was not with an interview with him. So it was an interview with a Twitter account, a person who owns a Twitter account who remains anonymous and who acts as sort of a, like, as far as I can understand it, he is sort of like a critic of different polling organizations and does his own polling and looks at the aggregates of polling numbers and sort of tries to pick out which ones are high quality, which aren't. He gave an allegation. He gave an interview in which he made this allegation, I believe, with a college newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the point is that a lot of people don't like the Sean McElwee guy. Someone said something inflammatory about him in an interview, and that claim, completely unsourced, no solid information at all. And in fact, the guy later admitted that he didn't know that it was $50,000, only that it was some amount of money. It went all over certain circles, and it directly impacted this guy's integrity and his reputation. And that seems to me to be a permanently baked in problem with social media and social networking, which is that people will always be credulous to what they want to hear, right? Like, people didn't like this guy, so they didn't bother to check the source and see if it was made up or real. And they shared this idea about him with no evidence based on that dislike. And you can see this in, like, from, like, you know, I think a much bigger and more meaningful scenario is if we were looking at, like, elections, right? The question of who's winning an election and who's losing an election. You can see the way that the bias towards a particular outcome is going to change what people are saying on the network. And people aren't going to be too rigorous with their checking sources and citing sources and being responsible if they're hearing what they want to hear. And I don't know that that's a problem that has a technocratic fix, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how that problem gets fixed with a tweak to a social media network, to its software or its policies or what.
I hate Twitter. I think about deleting mine all the time.
Soon after that, a disgraced pop science writer called Jonah Lehrer, he'd been caught plagiarizing and faking quotes, and he was drenched in shame and regret, he told me. And he had the opportunity to publicly apologize at a foundation lunch. This is going to be the most important speech of his life. Maybe it would win him some salvation. He knew before he arrived that the foundation was going to be live streaming his event. But what he didn't know until he turned up was that they'd erected a giant screen Twitter feed right next to his head. And here were some of the tweets that were cascading into his eyeline as he was trying to apologize. Jonah Lehrer boring us into forgiving him. And Jonah Lehrer has not proven that he is capable of feeling shame. And Jonah Lehrer is just a frigging sociopath. Imagine if this was an actual court and the accused was in the dock begging for another chance and the jury was yelling out, bored, sociopath. You know, when we watch courtroom dramas, we tend to identify with the kind-hearted defense attorney, but give us the power and we become like hanging judges.
I definitely think that there's something about social media that exacerbates this problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it predates social media. I mean, obviously, you know, different newspapers have different biases. The example of Fox News is one where you can, but I guess what's different about social media is that it has makes the immediate impression that it's just a bunch of people. It's not, it doesn't have a stated bias. It's not a curated, it's not a publication. And also the viral nature, what gets attention is more arbitrary than a publication with a gatekeeper and an editor and things like that, with some standards are put in place. But on the other hand, as someone who sort of made a career online, the fact of social media has evened the playing field a bit. It's given people who were maybe not coming out of the elite colleges an opportunity to garner an audience. And it does seem to have had a democratic effect, at least in some ways. So I wonder, do you think that the internet overall, the openness of the internet, and that democratic effect of creating a media environment which has a lot more players and is more open, could be preserved without the downside of social media? And then I have a follow-up question to that, because I don't know if I have an answer. If you don't have an immediate answer, I wouldn't be surprised. But what do you think?
Yeah, I don't have a very pat answer. I mean, I guess the first thing to say is just like, look, like the internet is a fact of life now, and that genie's not going back in the bottle anytime soon. Mm-hmm. Certainly, my ability to like sort of make a career as a pundit slash observer slash media critic slash whatever would not be possible without the affordances of the internet. Mm. I'm someone who, for a variety of reasons, most of which are self-inflicted, would just not be able to get a staff writing position at a major publication. And if I did have such a staff writing position, I'd be making significantly less money than I do as a crowdfunded person. Mm. Just because of the economics of media and where we're at. As someone who is constitutionally likely to complain about the internet, I try to sort of remind myself that, in fact, like, look, like, you know, my life is subsidized by the internet in an obvious financial way. That, you know, I wouldn't have access to so many of the influences that mean something to me in terms of, I mean, I would be getting much more of the official top-down view from nowhere, blessed by the elites perspective if I only had traditional media to go on, right? Mm-hmm. The breadth of what's out there is remarkable. I do think, though, that the problem of rewarding novelty and sensationalism over, what is, what you can provably true, what is buttressed by evidence and is sober and calm and rational, I think is a problem that's not going anywhere. And of course, we had some dynamics like this prior to the internet, right? I mean, there was a difference between the New York Times and the New York Post, right? Mm-hmm. Like the New York Post, for example, I believe, was a publication that went very hard on the Central Park Five story, right? Five young men of color who were accused of gang raping a jogger. That contributed to a witch hunt atmosphere that kicked off an enormous controversy in New York, and they were able to do so in part because they were sensationalist, which is sort of what New York tabloids have always been compared to the sort of sturdy, stentorian, just the facts, ma'am, New York Times. Mm. So, of course, that dynamic also existed prior to the internet. It's just, the constant fight for attention, the eyeballs on the thing that, who can get eyeballs on their thing is so deeply entangled with what is what people want to hear and what appears to be sensational or wild or extreme or over the top. And I think you can look at many or most internet communities, self-selected communities of different internet groups, where the most sort of out there crazy claims float to the top because they're the most extreme. And it's a problem I don't know how to fix.
You said something that the internet wasn't going anywhere. And I definitely agree that the internet, the infrastructure that isn't, especially all these phones, that people have, people are going to keep wanting to have smartphones. But I do think that the nature of social media is undergoing an alteration, which is pretty profound right now.
Right.
You have Facebook declining and young viewers or members, and I think declining overall, certainly losing a lot of its stock value. You have Twitter declining, actually, not because of Elon Musk. And I found out recently that on YouTube, like half of the views on YouTube are of shorts. And what's seeming to happen is that TikTok and its clones are it's creating a new social media experience that has really nothing to do with social media. It's you get these little 30 second to a minute long videos that are invariably trivial and sensationalistic, and but which also operate differently, that you do not communicate with people you're following on TikTok even as much as you might someone you're following on YouTube. And it just isn't a social network in that way, but it seems to be dominating the social networks, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. And I think even Twitter wants to get in on this.
Everybody uses YouTube. I mean, the gap between YouTube and the next highest thing that could be considered a social network is remarkable. Yeah. You know, so I don't know if you sort of track the controversy with Instagram. So some months back, there was like a protest on Instagram, which was undertaken by a bunch of celebrity accounts, which is that very sort of like unashamedly, the Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, made Instagram more like TikTok, where they, rather than sort of seeing the pictures of your friends slowly going into your feed as you scroll, they're favoring short form video, like what you see on TikTok. And they're also injecting way more celebrity and viral account stuff into your feed. And so what was once for many people an opportunity to sort of see pictures that their friends had taken, is now a TikTok light, where you're just getting algorithmically generated recommendations of short clips of video that have proven to be so successful for TikTok. I mean, I'm someone who is an old person, so I still use Facebook. You can't get away from the short form video on Facebook. It's dead center all the time. I'm someone who has somehow accumulated like 3,000 Facebook friends and 2,000 followers. So like the original experience of Facebook for me was, hey, I haven't seen this person in a long time. I wonder what they're up to. Whereas now it's just strangers pumping out viral content, viral video, viral images and stuff like that. Yeah, I would not be sad to see social media as traditionally construed died, but TikTok isn't much better. TikTok is the source of tons of misinformation. I have written on several occasions about the misinformation about mental health issues on TikTok. And they also happen to be owned by a Chinese firm that has been shown to be colluding with the Chinese government to use the app as spyware. So that's not great either.
Yeah. So I guess, you and I kind of agree that something is changing and it's not for the best, or it's not an improvement. But I do wonder if the kind of influence a platform like Twitter had amongst the elite journalists is going to go away as it becomes more and more like TikTok. It just is going to change the kind of use that the platform is used for. So I want to ask you just sort of a meta question, not about Meta the company.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please do consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons help to make sure that Sublation Media can continue to provide interviews, videos, books, and articles that are critical of the left from the left. If you are tired of remaining stuck within bourgeois ideologies and politics, help us sublate them both.